Iku Iluna, please rise. Ohea oko e ko ka aha, inahe kuleana imua o kea aha, ho o kolo kolo ki eke hanohano o kamoku aina o Hawaii. E nawe mai, e malio mai, I lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho ilalo, please be seated.
Please call the case.
SCWC 2485, Inri DM, arguing for petitioner DM, Phyllis Hironaka, arguing for respondent, State of Hawaii, Brian Vincent. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning to our counsel. Are you both ready to proceed? All right. Ms. Hironaka, 30 minutes for your argument, reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. So we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Mr. Vincent will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument as well. Please proceed. Oh, I'm so sorry. For counsel, you can take your mask off when you argue if you'd like to. You don't have to, but if you'd like to, that's fine.
Great. Kurt did tell us. Okay. May it please the court. Minor DM respectfully requests that this honorable court vacate the ICA majority's memorandum opinion and reverse the four family court orders as requested in his opening brief. Petitioner DM contends that the ICA gravely erred in two principal ways. One was ruling that the family court's challenged FOFs were not clearly erroneous and that the COLs were not wrong. And number two, affirming the family court's erroneous application of self-defense in several ways. For the purposes of the OA, the oral argument, I'm going to focus on the erroneous application of self-defense because the problems with the findings of fact, the FOFs and the COLs, become apparent from the erroneous self-defense analysis.
Ms. Hironaka, would you mind just moving
with the mic closer?
Put mic closer. Right by your mouth. You can actually.
Oh, yeah, you can raise it up so
raise it up. Yeah, you can.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a little daunting. I don't want to have it hit me in the nose.
Yeah, if it interferes with you, go ahead. You can.
Okay. Okay, with respect to the first point, with respect to the erroneous self-defense analysis, the first point is that the family court failed to analyze the subjective prong of the self-defense analysis regarding the minor's reasonable belief that he was allowed to use deadly force in this case. And there are two sort of sub-issues there. One is that the duty to retreat with complete safety must also be analyzed from his subjective perspective, and that the failure to apply the multiple attacker circumstance in evaluating his use of deadly force also caused the error in this analysis. With respect to the failure to analyze the subjective prong properly, defense believes that the family court basically analyzed the kind of like in a hindsight is 2020 sort of fashion. Okay. The family court said that deadly force, and I believe this is finding 41 and 42. In here. That the court said it doesn't find that the amount of force used was objectively reasonable under the circumstances of this case, and then lists a number of factors, beginning and culminating with getting the knife from the vehicle, coming out of the vehicle instead of staying in the vehicle, making a threatening statement, and ultimately resulting in minors stabbing the victim. FOF 42 also says retrieving the vehicle, the weapon from the vehicle, coming out of the vehicle with the weapon, making the threatening statement, and ultimately using the weapon constitutes deadly force. As pointed out by the dissent, frankly, the use of deadly force is actually when the stab occurs. Yes, those other circumstances may be considered in for example, determining the reasonableness of the minor's belief, et cetera. But things like coming out of the car or things like, not driving away, those are things that have nothing to do with the actual use of the deadly weapon.
Sure, Naka,
deadly
could force. You help yes. me on one issue? And this, the family court seemed to, and a lot of its analysis seemed to flow from its conclusion that the fight was over when the minor went and got the weapon from the car and came back out. There's conflicting testimony, sort of as I review the transcripts, but there would seem to be testimony that would support that conclusion. And I wanted to get your assessment. Do you think that was a clearly erroneous finding? And if it's not, how does that affect the analysis? Because again, what I see with the family court is the notion like, hey, the fight's over. He went to the car, he got a weapon, came back and like re-escalated the fight. That's a very rough way of putting it. But what's your take on that issue?
No, I believe that the fight was not over. And in the minor's subjective belief, I think that's clearly shown from his testimony, which of course the family court was free to believe or disbelieve as much or as little as he wished.
Ms. Hironaka,
yes.
I believe the ICA stated that you did not challenge the finding of fact that said that this fight was over.
There's two ways to look at these things. Yes, I did not challenge that, but there's an objective, sort of that the fight had paused. Okay. But in the minor's mind, he was not out of danger.
But the court stated, the family mm-hmm. court stated the fight was over and you didn't challenge it. So why can we visit it now if you haven't challenged it?
I when I looked at that finding of fact, I made a decision as to whether that was there, it was clearly erroneous or not. And I made a choice not to challenge it because there was a pause in the fight. So you could describe that as being over, and that could be over like 100% completely done. It could be a pause, but there was a break in the circumstances. And then clearly what happened from the minor's perspective is that when he went to the car to grab the knife and got out of the car and looked, he saw RL, the complainant, and quote unquote, his boys coming to mob me.
So it
supports his understanding that the fight was not really over and the need to protect himself with self-defense was still real and viable.
I wanted to follow up on that point. So.
Yeah.
You know, because I've heard a lot of analysis about the court failed to analyze his subjective point of view. I want to be sure I understand what you're saying, which is that although one might, looking at all the facts from, 5,000 feet after the incident, conclude the fight was over from the minor's point of view, the evidence suggests he was not aware that it was over or he perceived that he was still being threatened. Is that what you're?
That's correct. Yes. And in fact, that's what happened. Because when he turned around and he looked and those boys were coming to get him, really the only aggressor, the main aggressor was RL. And I looked at the testimony of the other witnesses. Hunter Zeller Cortez, the only non-minor, did not actually see that last part that led up to the stabbing because he was busy trying to de-escalate another friend. However, RL, EO, KJ, and the minor all testified that when the last part occurred, basically, RL ran at him, jumped at him, tackled him to the ground while the minor is holding the knife. So the family court found that it was an intentional stabbing. Okay. Looking at that from my, I would have argued that it was just purely accidental because what's going to happen when you jump at somebody and tackle them to the ground when they happen to be holding a knife in their hand? Likely that you're going to get stabbed. But regardless,
Ms. Hironaka,
yes.
Besides what the minor testified to, mm-hmm. I don't recall anybody else talk. The other witnesses all stated that it was a fight between the complaining witness and DM. I don't recall any other statement saying that because the DM says, I was afraid other people were coming at me. Nobody else says that mm-hmm. he was being hit by anybody else. And at the time, I think, and you objected to the court not including certain findings of facts about the state of the complaining witness. I think it's undisputed that the complaining witness was the one that charged DM.
Right.
At the time, the complaining witness was unarmed, didn't have a shirt on,
mm-hmm.
only had shorts on.
Mm-hmm.
So how believable is it, even if you look at it in the viewpoint of DM, that deadly force was necessary to avert death or serious bodily injury when the guy is just standing there in shorts with no shirt on and unarmed?
I mean, if you got to take the facts back to where the fight initially started,
okay,
which is
so
that
if you go back to the, so then you do take into consideration what happened before, because your argument is you only take into consideration when he's wielding the knife.
When you look at whether it's proper for his self-defense use, but as far as what did DM know, goes back to the initial fight, how RL approached him, how RL threw the first punch at
it's
him.
Still just the two of them though.
No, there are other people.
Who hit him?
Yes.
Well, according to him, but nobody else says that besides him.
I don't
Everybody
think...
said, oh, there are other scuffles going around,
there
going
were...
on.
Yes.
But,
Ms. Aranaka, did the court make a finding that the defendant was not credible on the notion of other individuals perhaps endangering him?
No. The only time that the court said that it was not credible was when DM testified as to how he caught RL when he leaped at him while he was holding the knife.
Let me ask you.
He also said he wasn't credible regarding intent to use the knife.
I don't recall that specifically. He did find the family court did find that he intended to use the knife, but I don't recall reading that he found that Miner's testimony was not credible with respect to his intent.
Well, doesn't justifiable use of force presuppose that an intentional act causing a crime might have happened? And, you know, that.
Yes.
Okay. Now let me ask you a question. You know, you raise what the dissent said that, you know, deadly force must be analyzed at the point or deadly force and the duty to retreat should be analyzed at the point that deadly force is used, not before. And you fault the majority for assessing the reasonableness of the minor's belief as a necessity of the use of force at the beginning, from when the point when he goes in and retrieves the knife from the car and comes out, you like get stabbed. But, you know, wasn't that just part of the majority's analysis of the objective prong, that the minor's acts were unreasonable regarding the necessary use of deadly force?
They could possibly be part of the objective prong, but I think what was missing, before you get, Lubong says that before you get to the objective analysis, you got to do the subjective analysis. And so if Miner did not know that the fight was over, if Miner did not know that he was no longer in danger and all the things that flow from that kick in, such as the duty to retreat and that it was unreasonable to bring out a knife and make a threat and all that kind of stuff, then you can say that, you know, the objective part is applicable, I guess, is what, I can't think of a better word for that. But you got to make the subjective analysis first. And then the majority seemed to take what it viewed as sort of the overview of all the evidence. Like in the majority's estimation, the fight was over, and it was only the fact that the minor went to the car and got the knife that, you know, caused it to restart. However, there was testimony from at least a couple of the DM testified, and I...
Sorry to interject here.
Yeah.
I want to ask sort of what some of the Chief Justice asked. You know, how is our analysis really impacted if we consider this to be one incident? And I think the complaining witness kind of said it's first and second round, which suggests it's part of the same fight.
Yes.
How is our analysis really impacted between one altercation versus two altercations?
I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at there, with respect to it was really one. There was a break, and then there was a second altercation, right? And if it's all part of, but it's all part of.
Wait, is that what you're saying? Are you suggesting that this was two separate altercations,
nope,
or just one event?
One event. There was that break where Minor was able to get up and run to the car, but beyond that, the complainant, RL, kept coming and coming and coming. And, you know, the testimony was from RL's friends now that other people, their friends, were trying to hold him back. He kept breaking away. You know, Hunter had pushed the two guys apart. People were walking around with their hand on, you know, telling them, calm down, et cetera. But, you know, DM just stood there. And RL kept coming and coming and coming. And then there were RL's friends that were also acting menacingly towards DM. So in that situation, he feels outnumbered. He's in a strange place. He has no friends cohorts.
Is the subjective and objective analysis impacted by the fact that the complaining witness said that only between 5 and 15 seconds elapsed between when he was pulled off the miner and the miner went and got the knife?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Okay, the complaining witness says, you know, this first round is broken up, but then really within 5 to 15 seconds, the miner has gone to the car, which is apparently only 5 to 10 feet away.
Correct.
Gets the knife, says, who wants to get stabbed? And then the other miner launches into the tackle. You know, how does this at most half a minute interval affect the subjective objective analysis?
I would disagree that it was at most a 30-second interval. If RL said 5 to 10 seconds, et cetera, then it appears that the fight is still continuing, but how it affects the subjective analysis is, as far as DM is concerned, the fight's still going on. He just happened to scoot away.
Do you agree that mm-hmm. the subjective analysis starts from the first time these two individuals interacted?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Could I ask your help, Ms. Hironaka, in applying the principle I think you mentioned in your opening as to the multiple attackers and the extent to which that should be considered in evaluating deadly force? Because it's my understanding you're contending that was not considered either at all or sufficiently,
I think,
by the trial court. So could you help me with your analysis as to why you're taking that position and the extent to which that principle from De Leon applies here?
It goes again to the minor's subjective belief as to what kind of force is necessary to protect himself.
And why do you conclude that wasn't considered sufficiently by the trial court?
Because the trial court made no findings, no mention of the fact that there were other boys, including RL, coming to beat him up. It just didn't seem to factor in there at all, the fact that there were other confidants or whatever, friends of RL, that were appearing to go after the minor.
Are you finished? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay. If you are saying this, his subjective belief in the analysis takes into consideration the sufficient force to protect himself, but at the same time you're saying self-defense only applies to when he's using his, I assume you're embracing Judge Nakasone's analysis that it's when he actually uses the force.
Correct.
But if you're analyzing subjective force as to what he was thinking, why can't it go into, when Justice Edens asked you, you said it starts from the first time they interact. Right. So why would just the act of self-defense, the knife stab, be the first time you look at deadly force?
I want to talk a little bit about Matu'u, which was cited by the...
Can you talk into the mic a little bit?
I'm sorry. I wanted to talk about Matu'u, which was cited by the ICA. And in that case, there was an argument between three cousins that lived together. The one cousin that eventually died was always bullying Matu'u and picked a fight that day, and they ended up scrapping. The third cousin came into the picture to stop and break it up, okay, and ended up fighting with the decedent, okay? While they were kind of occupied, those two, Matu'u went to the kitchen and got a knife and came back and started yelling at the decedent and ended up stabbing him. And he claimed self-defense and he only remembered one stab. However, the body showed that there were like four wounds, et cetera. And then the analysis...
There was a second knife, wasn't there?
That there was a second knife found near the body. So the analysis was... It was basically that he wasn't defending himself because the decedent was involved with the other cousin at the time. The other cousin apparently said something like, stop, you don't need to do this or whatever, and got sliced by the knife. And that, apparently he stabbed him several times while that cousin was tending to his wound that Matu'u had inflicted. So that the decedent was not attacking Matu'u, and they said that Matu'u's belief that he needed to use deadly force at that time was unreasonable. They also said that Matu'u was not protecting third cousin because third cousin kind of was handling it and he sort of jumped into the middle of it. Those circumstances are very different from what was happening in DM's case.
Okay, in DM's case, if you say it's only when he wields the knife, mm-hmm. that's when the deadly force analysis starts. Suppose just before he wields the knife, he says to the complaining witness, I'm really mad at you for besting me, beating me up. I'm going to kill you now. And then he stabs him. So are you saying that statement can't be part, you have to disallow that statement, and it's only when he...
No, I mean, I think it comes into, because it's part of what you explained was part of the stab.
Okay, so then why is the ICA wrong in taking into consideration he went to get the mere seconds before he went to get the knife and turned around and said, who'd like it stabbed?
Mm-hmm.
Why is the court wrong in using that in its analysis of looking at the subjective viewpoint?
The testimony was that he said it to scare people off. And in fact, the family court found that it was okay. It's not, in fact, if you look at the definition under 703-300, it says that deadly force does not include a statement that, I'm either a show of a weapon or a statement right. that I'm going to use this weapon. That is not part of deadly force.
Why can't it be if the statement you used before is, it's not just the brandishing though, it's who like gets stabbed.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't the court use that in looking at his subjective belief and the actions that he takes?
The actions that he takes were that he made that statement and he stood there. And that was stated by EO as well as DM. So there were two witnesses that said that he didn't move towards the complainant in any regard. The complainant, EO, et cetera, all said that at that point in time, RL got mad because he saw DM with a knife. And that's when he ran at him, launched himself at him, and tackled him to the ground.
If it's relevant that he stood there
mm-hmm.
and didn't move, and that was before he lunch with a knife, why is it not relevant that he went to go get the knife and he said, who liked get stabbed?
I'm sorry, say that again.
If you're, yeah. I mean, on the one hand, you're saying it's only relevant when he actually uses the knife, but mm-hmm. you're saying, hey, he stood there. He wasn't the one who charged him. He stood there. And I think it's undisputed that he did. Mm-hmm. But if you are using the fact that he stood there, mm-hmm. and that was before the use of the knife,
yes.
why isn't it also relevant that he said, who liked get stabbed? And he was the one that ran and got the knife.
The running and getting the knife is not part of deadly force. Is not standing, part of the use of deadly force.
Is standing there and not using the knife, that's not part of deadly force either. But you're saying that that's part of, that should be taken in consideration.
Because it's part of his subjective belief, yes.
Well, why isn't running and getting the knife part of his subjective belief?
It is. I mean, what my complaint or my irritation with the finding was that those particular factors were used as what constituted deadly force. And I don't believe that they do constitute deadly force.
Yeah, I can see that.
Okay. So whether it, but they do go to, they're relevant. They go to his subjective belief as to whether deadly force was necessary at the time that it did get used. Yes.
What about the trial courts or family courts finding that he could have extricated himself from the situation? In other words, the family court said, you know, he could have stayed in the car, could have called his cousin. And so even if you assume the fight was still sort of ongoing, he could have found another way to keep himself safe. What's your assessment of that issue?
I think the family court was clearly erroneous in those two conclusions. If you are in a, you know, if you lock yourself in the car, you're making yourself a sitting duck. You've got a mob of angry boys outside. You know, the next logical thing that you would think is that they're going to start shaking the car. They're going to break the windows. And then you're stuck. You can't move. It would be better if you were outside the car so you could either fight or run if it came down to that.
Ms. Hironaka, after he stabbed the complaining witness, he called to his cousin and said, hey, we got to get out of here.
He went to find his cousin.
And he said his cousin was five cars away.
Right.
And he
went to his cousin.
And this is after he'd already stabbed the guy. So you'd think that the mob, if there was a mob, the mob would be even madder. Why isn't it a logical inference for the court to say, if you did it after, you could have done it before. You
did
could have called
after?
To your cousin and gotten in the car and driven away.
Okay, again, under the circumstances, I don't believe that that was a good possibility because before the stab, let's kind of change the ending here and say that if he went to go find his cousin, the cousin is, you know, chatting up with some people down a few cars down and he says, gotta leave because, you know, these guys are after me. Again, the mob is going to follow him.
How's that different from after he stabbed the guy? If there was a mob, wouldn't the mob have been the same or even more incensed after he stabbed DM? So why is
based on what happened and the testimony there, I think everybody was in shock. Hunter said that he didn't even realize that RL got stabbed until later when he saw blood and things like that. Even during the point in time where RL had taken Minor to the ground and did get injured. He was so amped up that he was still punching the Minor. And the Minor testified that finally his wound basically made him, RL said, I felt weird. And he rolled over and then he realized that he was bleeding and he was injured.
How is that different though?
Because the crowd of onlookers are absorbing what's going on. And then everybody's worried about, you know, take care of RL, take him to the hospital, whatever. That seemed to be the focus. And the whole business about fighting with DM kind of went on the side. Plus the fact that DM said that when I made that threatening statement, everybody else except for RL backed off. The other boys that were with him backed off.
Ms. Hironaka, I know your time's just about up.
I know.
Wanted to get a chance to get your clarification about the manner in which the trial court should apply subjective versus the objective analysis. So is it your proposition and in terms of the determination that has to take place in imagining the mindset of the defendant, is it your position that in this case, what took place is that the trial court was not taking into consideration in determining the subjective frame of mind of the defendant in this case, was not taking into consideration the facts as they were seen by the defendant? A fact such as going to the car, the interpretation of the actions of the defendant before the use of force, meaning that there wasn't a problem. The fight had stopped. Now, perhaps in applying a point of view of looking at it from objectable, objective reason, and looking at it from the second prong in terms of the objective analysis versus subjective, okay, perhaps you could take that point of view. But first, the first step is to try to get into the mind of the defendant, right? And your position is that that wasn't done in the way that the facts were being perceived, because from the point of view of the defendant, when he went to the car, he didn't think it was over. Mm-hmm. When he got the knife, he didn't think it was over. Mm-hmm. When he stood there and said, does anybody want to be stabbed? He didn't do that with the understanding it was over. And of course, then when he was rushed, he didn't think it was over. So your point is, although maybe another person thinking reasonably would have said, I don't need to go to the car, I need to just get out of here, it looks like everything is over, that wasn't an analysis that was available to the trial judge.
Right.
He had to look at it from the point of view
of the minor,
of the defendant.
Correct. And to add,
PJ, can I just ask, I know her time
please,
is up.
Okay.
Go ahead. I had something to finish in your, but go ahead.
Thank you. Can you explain to me why you think the ICA said that even though the trial court didn't explicitly make findings regarding the subjective beliefs of the minor, but that findings of fact 37 and conclusion of law 12 were sufficient to uphold the court's, the family court's ruling because implicitly discussed the defendant's subjective beliefs?
Okay. I just have to say that I disagree. I think they're wrong. Both of those, the findings of fact and the conclusion of law that you mentioned, 12 and 37, that you can't imply or take from it that the family court implicitly made the analysis that the majority attributed to it.
Mr. Anaka, and I will give you time for rebuttal.
Okay. So
I just want to clarify. So when we're talking about assessing from the point of view of the minor, if I understand your argument, there's both a subjective analysis and an objective analysis. And there's one point where the family court sort of said, well, even assuming he subjectively believed actually the use of deadly force was necessary, it's perhaps not clear, you know, if that was a very limited finding or not. But what your argument is that in assessing whether it was objectively reasonable to do what the minor did, we have to assess that from his point of view. Is that your argument? In other words, even though piecing this all together, we might now say, hey, the fight was dialing back, kids were settling down, things were probably okay. We have to look at it from his point of view, and from his point of view, he was under attack. Is that?
Yes. Yes. And there was something I was going to say in response to one of the things that you said. That the self-defense had to be, that they should have analyzed it following the Lubong analysis, right? Which is Lubong. They should have followed the Lubong analysis, which is to look at the subjective first, make that analysis before you go to the objective. And in this particular case, it seemed that there was very little emphasis given to the subjective, and the court went straight to the objective. And that's kind of what created the problem. Before I sit down, I wanted to finish responding to what you had said about, that whether he could have retreated in complete safety. I was talking about staying in the car would not have been with complete safety, and then driving away also was not, could not have been done with complete safety. Number one, he didn't have there was no testimony about who had the keys to the car, although the cousin is the one who drove. The cousin was the designated driver. It was a cousin's car. So you can kind of infer that the cousin probably had the keys. Second, there was no testimony or evidence that Minor even knew how to drive. He's 17, but there was no evidence about that. And then the third part to that is for the minor to leave and leave his cousin there would be unthinkable. And one other thing that I could think about is that trying to get the car out with a mad crowd around it, that's even more dangerous because you're endangering the other people that are probably trying to attack you. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hironaka. Mr. Vincent, we're going to change out the surface there. Just give us one moment.
Good morning.
Morning.
Let me just start out by talking about the law and maybe take the liberty of trying to ascertain what the ICA dissent assumptions were when they were evaluating this case. And to be fair to the ICA dissent, I think their assumptions were like this. Minor got beat up, okay, knocked to the ground, managed to escape, went to the car, got a knife, came back, and thought that that would stop the fight because he thought everybody would back off, okay? And it turns out it didn't, okay? A complaining witness rushed him again. And I think ICA dissent thinks that up to that point, he was being reckless with respect to whether or not he should bring a knife to the fight. When the guy rushed him, that changed everything. And that the intent should be evaluated at that precise moment, not including what happened before and so forth. And there is a language in the statute which indicates that the use of the force should be judged based on the reasonable belief of the defendant at the time the force was used. So I think the assumptions that I see dissent based it on are somewhat shaky in the sense that the defendant could well have formed an intent to stab the complaining witness when he got the knife in the car. It's possible. And if that was the case, it would have been just premeditated assault in the first degree or attempted assault in the first degree in this case. But I think that even if you look at it from the point of view of the ICA dissent, I think the state still disproved beyond a reasonable doubt that there was one of the five harms. He was actually had a reasonable fear of one of the five harms that's listed in the statute. The most pertinent one being serious bodily injury. And second of all, he had a reasonable, the state disproved that he could not escape safely and complete safety at that point. And there's a number of facts that support that. And I think I think the court made those findings in the conclusions of Law 9 and 11. And I think it's only 12 that somewhat confuses the issue as to whether or not this, you know, everything before the second time he attacked the defendant should be kind of like forgotten, right? I mean, I think in this case, the common sense view of the facts is that blaming witness would not have been stabbed if he would have just stayed in the car or left the scene. And I think that's a common sense interpretation of the statute that...
If I can interrupt you, Mr. Benson, I'm sorry, but while you're on that point, you're saying it's a common sense proposition that there are a number of ways he could have ended the fight without pulling out a knife.
That's correct. Right?
But we don't get that far in this case until the judge tries to determine what's in the mind of the defendant, right? Because you have to go through the subjective reasonableness step. So the judge has to try to understand what the perspective was of the defendant. Now, then a reasonableness standard can be applied. I mean, if the defendant believes that what's happening is he is in a situation in which he is being overrun by a vast army and there's not an army there, and as a result, he uses very strong force. Okay, maybe that applying the objective standard means that it's unreasonable. But first, it's necessary to determine from the defendant's point of view. And in this case, would you concede that DM did not come to the conclusion that he could stop the fight by doing something other than getting the knife? I mean, he didn't have a conversation with somebody where he said, I know the fight's over, but I don't care. I want to continue it and take the knife and stab somebody. I'm just asking you, how can the court, where are the facts that would suggest that the defendant didn't think, that DM didn't think it was necessary to defend himself?
I think that the family court was well aware of the correct standard, okay? And because in conclusional law number 9, it says the reasonableness of the minor's belief that the use of such protective force was immediate and necessary should be determined from the viewpoint of a reasonable person in the minor's position.
Well,
under the circumstances in which the minor was aware.
I was asking for your help in how to apply that, apply that standard, because you were suggesting that there was a reasonable way for the fight to end. But isn't it true that you can't apply that analysis up front? You have to determine first what it was that the defendant thought. Now, if the court says subjective reasonableness means that in this case there was an easy way out, then that would seem to perhaps imply, as the petitioner is saying, it would seem to perhaps imply that the judge didn't get it. He didn't know how to apply the standard because the defendant certainly didn't think there was an easy way out.
Well, the defendant's view was objectively unreasonable, and that I think that's clearly what the family court found.
Okay.
Is that,
so, I mean,
he left the fight once. He got to the car, got in the car, and then came back to the fight with a weapon this time.
Isn't it come back to this question whether the fight was over or not, and whether that's clearly erroneous? In other words, you know, if he's terrified, he's like getting smacked around, there's a gang of people around him, he runs to the car, he thinks his only way to defend himself is to come out with a knife and brandish it. That's one set of facts. Another set of facts, like the fight's over and, you know, things are calming down, but he's, you know, he's really mad and he wants to like up things again and goes and gets a knife and comes back out. So the family court found that it was two separate incidents. And that seemed to be, as I said to Ms. Hironaka, that seemed to be really foundational to its approach. Is that clearly erroneous or not, that finding?
Well, there was a definite break in between the two incidents. The ICA dissent seems to believe that the complaining witness rushing him a second time breaks the incident into a new and different phase, right? Where you have to consider only what happens after that, right?
Did the did the family court really consider this as two separate incidents, though? I'm looking at finding of fact 22, where the family court finds that the first altercation was partially broken up when HC stepped in between and attempted to break up the fight, which then continued somewhat as a second altercation that the court views as a continued part of the first altercation. So the family court seems to be a little bit, you know.
Well, if you're
it's in a little bit confusing here. Was it one altercation or not?
If you're in doubt as to what the family court's findings were, this court could remand it back to that judge and ask him to make specific findings of credibility as to certain aspects. And that would be that could be done, since this was a bench trial, without having to present new evidence.
Well, wasn't that actually three altercations? They were fighting. Hunter Zeller Cortez breaks in and says, stop it. And then they continued fighting and then it broke up.
Yeah, in that respect, yeah, there could be like you could consider it as to be almost three separate episodes or three different phases of the fight.
Mr. Vincent, findings of fact 40 and 41 talk about the use of force not being objectively reasonable. And findings of fact 37 and 41, to support that objective finding, the family court talks about what the minor should have done, such as staying in the vehicle. And so the court is using sort of this alternative course of action, the could-haves, to support its ultimate objective, reasonable finding. But when I look at 703.304 subsection 5, that's the duty to retreat with complete safety. That's a subjective inquiry. So does a defendant have to combat this could have, should have retreat argument twice at the objective stage and then later at the subjective inquiry?
I think that it's a subjective objective standards for both whether you think you're based with the five harms, but also as to whether or not you have you can retreat with complete safety. I think those are identical standards with respect to I think they're contained in the same statute. I think
I guess what I'm wondering is was the court somehow creating almost like a new objective retreat requirement on the objective analysis? Because it was using the retreat and the could-haves and should-haves to support its objective finding.
No, I think that the family court's finding was that he had retreated once safely before, so he knew he could retreat. And then he came back, and when he attacked him again, he should have known, a reasonable person in his position should have known, that he could retreat again.
But in terms of that finding, 37, Minor could have gone to the vehicle and, instead of getting the knife, could have extricated himself from the situation if he stayed in the vehicle, or he could have left the area but chose not to. What basis is there for saying that he would have been safe if he stayed in the vehicle? I mean, isn't it common sense that cars' windshields are, broken pretty regularly with rocks or bats or whatever?
Yeah, but...
And he could have left the area but chose not to. Isn't that there really is no evidence that he had the key, right?
I think he testified he did not have a key.
Right.
And nobody testified that he did have a key. Okay, so it's true, he probably did not have a key. He could have locked it from the inside. Most cars, you don't have to have a key to lock.
And that it makes it completely protective.
Not completely protected. And I'll grant you that windows can be broken.
Pretty easily, they're only broken.
But I think that the testimony at trial, which even the defendant's own testimony, was that there were people there who were trying to break up the fight. Okay, I think that was undisputed, that complaining witnesses' friends were trying to break up the fight. Okay? And if one friend was physically intervening, a girl was trying to calm him down, right? So defendant's trying to characterize this as all Eva Beach against me, okay? It's clearly not that, okay? Defendant, the complaining witness had people that were trying to break up the fight as well, okay? And another thing was is that defendant admitted that he had a cell phone with him, okay? And he was asked, well, did you try to call 911? Or I think he was asked, I'm not sure, but he could have called 911, okay? And or he could have ran to the nearest house. I don't know where the Mr. nearest Vincent, house is to dispute.
But I'm sorry to interrupt you, but mm-hmm. you this is helpful because you're reciting a number of scenarios that you think would have been better for him to do, some of the, which were noted by the ICA. But in determining the subjective state of mind and then determining whether it's something that would be reasonable under the objective standard, is the test whether the defendant exercised the best possible discretion? Is the test whether the defendant did what would have been perhaps in hindsight the best thing? Or is the test whether from the defendant's point of view, looking at the facts as he saw it, in other words, you've talked about how there are people that were trying to resolve the fight, there was a phone and everything, but there is a realistic set of facts in the sense of being, it seems, apparent and undisputed that somebody there that night was interested in creating an argument and even a physical one with DM. Would that be fair to say?
A complaining witness was the one who's the only one on record at
that. Right. So there was somebody that wanted
an animosity towards him, apparently.
Right. So it clearly there was a threat.
From we can complaining witness, but not necessarily from.
Okay. Well, from let's say from the complaining witness, you could, I guess, look at this record. I think it's a tough sell, but you could look at the record and say, actually, nobody else was involved in creating a threatening atmosphere. But let's assume it was just this one person who was so agitated, even though he's not wearing a shirt, and even though he's looking at a knife, decides he's going to rush the rush the DM and jump on top of him and try to fight. So I don't know that the idea that there are other ways he could have handled it necessarily disqualifies him from coming to a conclusion that under these circumstances, this is one thing he could do. And he didn't take the knife and run at him and try to stab him. He was just standing there. That's been undisputed too. So you have undisputed, he's the aggressor. And undisputed, he's the aggressor in the face of a knife. So,
well, let's discuss what kind of harm he would have had to reasonably fear in order to justify the use of deadly force.
Yes,
and that is seriously bodily injury.
Perhaps you could address the concern that was expressed by the petitioner about the use of the De Leon standard. Right, under these circumstances, it's appropriate to keep in mind that there were multiple attackers, and De Leon would say that that's something that had to at least be considered. So when you're explaining this idea about the reasonableness, to what extent did the circuit court take into consideration?
Let's talk about De Leon first, and then we'll talk about what is serious bodily injury. Okay. So in De Leon, the court simply made the common sense finding that just because somebody attacks you with only fists without a weapon doesn't necessarily disqualify you for a self-defense instruction or a self-defense in that situation. And because our statute doesn't talk about the attacker having a deadly weapon or not having it, it merely talks about whether or not the defendant had a reasonable belief in the circumstances under which he was, that he was threatened with one of the five harms, okay? So if he was attacked by say, a Bruce Lee without a weapon, okay, who can kill somebody with his hands, apparently, okay, he would have a objectively reasonable apprehension of serious bodily injury or death, perhaps. Okay. On the other hand, if he was attacked by a group of people who really just didn't have the wherewithal, okay, to cause serious bodily injury, just because there was multiple attackers wouldn't mean that he has a reasonable expectation. So I think that
right,
you don't. DeLeon is just stating a common sense fact that is one of the things that has to be considered.
That's right.
When when considering,
how would you say that that analysis was considered in this case? What about the findings of fact?
That I think that those I think those were considered, and there was evidence. Defendant got on the stand and testified that he testified that at least one person hit him, perhaps the second one. I think he confounded the second one with the first one.
I said what the evidence is, whether it was considered, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I was really asking about the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Where does it appear that this DeLeon consideration was applied? Perhaps it's implied, but I didn't know if
I think it's there, implied.
It's explicit.
Yeah, I think it's implied. I don't know if it's explicitly laid out anywhere, but it's implied. And I think that brings us to the second question. What is seriously about serious bodily injury? Okay. I think it's illustrative of what serious bodily injury is by determining what serious bodily injury is not. Okay. And serious bodily injury is not substantial bodily injury. And substantial bodily injury is broken bones or severe concussions. So if defendant in this situation had a reasonable belief that complaining witness was going to break his bone or give him a severe concussion, that was insufficient as a matter of law to justify self-defense in that situation. And that's, I think, if you look at the facts, there's nothing that rises, I think, even a substantial bodily injury in this case.
Mr. Vincent, okay, the two-prong test, the first one is you look at the subjective belief of the defendant, and the finder of fact puts itself in the shoes of the defendant. Now, you keep adding something about reasonableness. Is reasonableness part of the determination of putting yourself in the shoes of the defendant?
Well, I think I would parse it up into three different steps here. First of all, there has to be an actual subjective belief, and that can be unreasonable, okay? But if the defendant clearly doesn't even have a actual subjective belief, then the analysis ends there, okay? Second place, they need to go and examine what he knew what he knew at the time. And that's going to have to be established by circumstantial evidence, the reality is, okay? It's like state of mind and so forth, okay? Once you figured out what the circumstances that defendant was aware of at the time, then you apply the reasonably objective standard, reasonable person standard. And I think that the family court did that in this case.
So if the defendant in a case testified, I know the guy was naked, but I just had a feeling he had a sword down his back that he was going to pull out. And there's no, you know, and the people are around, there's no, he doesn't have a sword. But if the defendant said, I think he had a sword or I think he had a gun, and there's, does the finder of fact still analyze it in terms of the first step is?
Well, I think then the court would have to make a credibility determination as to whether or not that was, well, I'd say would a reasonable person believe that?
Well, the prong is requisite belief.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, we don't have any indication of any weapons in this case. And in fact, on page 23 of the transcript where the talk when he where he's testifying, he's saying no, nobody had any weapons, nobody had any knives, nobody had any guns.
So you're saying that the requisite belief that deadly force was necessary to avert death or serious bodily injury. Does the court make a credibility finding if it puts itself in the shoes of the defendant?
I mean, I think that the court kind of has to put themselves in the kind of audio visual position of the defendant in order to come to a conclusion as to the reasonableness of the defendant's position.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Did the court make a finding with respect to deadly force in terms of whether or not 703-300 says the production of a weapon, as long as the actor's intent is limited to creating an apprehension that the actor will use deadly force if necessary, does not constitute deadly force. So did the court make any type of finding as to what DM's intent was?
I think it's a little bit unclear, to be frank with you. Let me look at that. Which conclusion of law?
That's, is it? Well, 703-300.
Yeah. No, but there was a finding of fact which was somewhat unclear, I thought.
Forty-two, I think.
Okay.
The court says, statute, and then says, however, retrieving the weapon from a vehicle, coming out of the vehicle with the weapon, making the threatening statement, and
ultimately using
the weapon. It's
kind of unclear as to whether. I mean, it was not deadly force for the self-protection justification purposes, but he doesn't go that extra step and say, well, what was his intent at that point? Was it to just stab him no matter what? Or was it just, I'm only going to stab him if he rushes me again? You know, I guess that's the question. I think that would have clarified things a little bit more in this case.
So those facts go into the intent as to whether the necessary force was reasonable?
I think, definitely.
Can I ask a question about 703-304? Now, 703-304 says that the use of force, you know, must be immediately necessary, but the use of deadly force doesn't have the adverb immediately preceding necessary. Does the adverb immediately for non-deadly force mean a tighter time element than for deadly force when it's necessary?
Yeah, and I think it's probably legislative intent to create a situation where they don't want to create situations where, like, arguably in this situation and other situations, I think in the case in De Leon was one of those, pulled out a gun, right? And complaining with, well, one of the people that was shot was saying, hey, you know what? One gun ain't gonna stop all of us, right? Yeah, you know, it didn't stop all of them, but it stopped one of them. Okay, and I think that the defendant, the legislature doesn't want that happening. Okay, they want people to stay away from conflicts with weapons. So,
You know, Hajik 7.01A says that, or instructs that, the use of deadly force must be immediately necessary. Now, that conflicts with the plain language of 703-304. Is Hajik 7.01A wrong? I'll withdraw. You know, and once again, Mr. Vincent, I want to thank you for your professional arguments.
Okay.
Every time you've been, at least before me, it's been a pleasure to have you. So thank you for your responses.
Yeah. I mean, you might, in light of this case, you might want to consider the instructions again, but thank you very much.
Well, anything else, Mr. Vincent, at this time?
No, Your Honor.
Very well. We'll hear some rebuttal from Ms. Hironaka. Thank you, Mr. Vincent. We could change on the thing.
Again, may it please the court. My first response to the state's argument is that the state a couple of times said that the defendant got the knife from the car and quote unquote came back instead of staying in the car or taking some other action. When it's clear from the testimony of the witnesses, the defendant never came back or approached the minor. The only one who said that the minor reapproached him was the complainant, who said that he reapproached him at a fast walking speed or something very odd. But that kind of belies the fact that that RL then went and jumped and tackled him. And the other thing that I wanted to respond to was that there was no evidence that he could have retreated safely before using the deadly force. and I still want to fall back on the correct analysis for self-defense is the Lubong analysis, and that you've got to look at the subjective prong first, go through that analysis before you look at the objective. And then with respect to the discussion on De Leon, De Leon had in kind of a way parallel circumstances to what the minor experienced here. Mr. De Leon did have a weapon, a gun, as Mr. Vincent pointed out. He was in a parking lot again at night all by himself. And there were at least three, but I would say four of the complainant and his buddies who they'd had a prior altercation with before at a club were coming toward him. And so the testimony was is that De Leon pulled out a gun, showed it to them so that they were clear that he had a weapon. And then he fired warning shots, two in the ground, one in the air. And at that point in time, the other three people that were with the complainant, the decedent, ran away or backed off. But the decedent said to him, similar to what RL said to the minor here, "What, you think one gun is going to stop us all?" And then he shot him from what turned out to be an arm's length away. So really that the decedent was right on him at the time that he employed the deadly force. So that's quite similar to what to the circumstances here with the minor.
Is it what if the family court was right that the fight was essentially over? How does that if basically the situation has cooled off and the minor knew that it had cooled off, is the minor able to come back out with a weapon under those circumstances and then be able to claim self-defense when someone challenges him?
Well, as you know, I disagree that the minor believed that the fight was over. But the evidence did show that when he came out of the car with the knife, that he just stood there at the car while making that statement in the hopes of keeping the attackers at bay. So at that point in time, when RL ran at him, flew himself in the air and tackled him down to the ground, the fight was on again, or the attack was on. And so he was entitled at that time to use the knife in self-defense.
What do you think is the consequence of, as Justice Edens has pointed out, the dissent misquotes the statute in talking about deadly force being immediately necessary? Do you think that, how does that impact the analysis when the statute says, just talks about necessary and not immediately necessary?
I'm not sure how to answer that one. I mean, I obviously had not recognized that there was a difference between the Hodgick that Justice Edens pointed out and what the statute said. I didn't focus on that at all. So I really haven't thought about that.
Could I ask you to clarify, Ms. Hironaka, your request, I believe, for us to reverse the
Correct.
Decision as opposed to remand for a new trial?
Yes.
Why? why reverse rather than remand for a new trial?
Because I believe that the evidence is sufficient to show that, okay, if the analysis had been done correctly, the outcome would have been different.
I mean, as a matter of law, we would determine that in this case, the justification defense applied.
I'm sorry.
As a matter of law, we would determine that the self-defense was proven, or the government failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he didn't act in self-defense. Is that
yes.
the conclusion you're suggesting we should reach?
Yes.
Well, anything further for the court at this
time? Nothing further.
All right. Thank you to both of our attorneys for your argument today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Iku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'oku ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo ki ke hanohano o kamoku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.